back-to-back nights of recording. A lot has happened since the last time we met, Dave. Just so many things.
24 whole hours.
Yeah, I think actually like almost on the dot.
Yeah.
24 whole hours since we recorded last. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So what's going on?
You know, I've been working. Tomorrow I'm going to buy a van. It's a big step in a man's life. In your journey of fatherhood, sometimes there comes a moment where your miniature van that you've been driving around is no longer sufficient.
Your little mini horse is no longer.
Right.
Step up to a Clydesdale.
Can't fit on the mini horse anymore. So I'm going to buy a 12-passenger van tomorrow.
That sounds expensive and fun.
It is both.
Yes.
I am excited. Undoubtedly expensive.
I'm on that train as well, about to have to pull that trigger myself.
I wish the best to you.
Yes.
May your endeavors be fruitful.
It is exhausting.
May they be less expensive than mine. I know.
You know what? I know for a fact it will be.
You know, I. Your lips to God's ears.
Mm-hmm. Not easy though.
But that's what I mean. I honestly am excited. It's gonna be fun.
It is fun to spend a bunch of money. Mm-hmm. In one sense.
It is.
Yeah.
I don't know. You're right.
Like,
it is.
You buy a house, you buy a big car, you know, tractor, you buy something big. It's like, this is fun.
Right. So that's in the last 24 hours. That's the only thing that has materialized. That it wasn't just in the 24 hours. It's been in the works.
That is an expensive 24 hours.
The last 24 hours has
solidified
seen
it.
A lot of, yes.
Solidified.
It's happening.
Man, that's a lot. Well, I'll tell you this. So I hinted last episode about just all the things that are kind of happening in my life. And one of the things that I kind of mentioned was like both my cars went out right before Haley gave birth to Mary, right? And,
yeah.
Which was incredibly chaotic and ironic, or however you want to look at it, that both cars go out. So my van goes out. Take it to the shop. As I'm pulling up to pick up the van, my truck's transmission goes out. I'm literally crawling into the body shop.
Which is honestly rude.
Incredibly rude. At like 15 miles an hour, I have people honking behind me, you know, as I'm going down the street just trying to make it there because I can't get out of first gear. So I pull up. I'm like, okay, fine. I'll drop this one off and pick this one up.
Just trade you.
I'll trade you. I'm really helping the local economy. And
noble.
Yes, some would say. And so I'm driving the van that just got worked on, and all of a sudden this weird light goes off in the van that says low voltage. I'm like, what? Like, I've never seen that one before.
I will add some more voltage.
Yeah, I don't know. Like,
get some more volts.
Yeah, where's the hand crank? I don't know. Do we need to like get some more? Anyway,
why are you telling me this?
So
what do you want me to do about?
So I do what every guy does, is like, well, I'll go to ChatGPT and like figure out like, what does this mean?
Yeah.
And it basically says like, your alternator is out and you have about 30 minutes or 30 miles to get to where you want to go and your car is going to stop. I am 45 miles away from my house. Okay, well, I'm going to try this. I literally get about 30 miles and everything goes crazy in my van. Every single light goes off. Every single warning light goes off. The cars are jolting like and revving. Without me even hitting the gas, like it's revving without me touching the gas pedal.
It feels safe.
This feels very safe.
Wow, it's really working well now.
Yeah. So I pull over and I think, okay, what should I do? And I remember the story that Jeff Cavins told us. So this whole story is about how Jeff Cavins and I are almost identical. And so Jeff Cavins told us a story. I don't know if he told it on air or if it was just when we were with him.
I think I did tell it. okay. on our show.
So Jeff Cavins is driving down. There's a broken car with a lady on the side of the road, and he says, like, the Lord moves him to stop to try to help this lady. Pops open the hood, and he tells the lady, basically, like, listen, I know nothing about cars.
He knows about as much of mechanics as I do about, like, brain surgery.
Right. And he said, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to pray over this car, and then I'm going to tell you to turn it on.
I want you to go get the driver's seat. I'm going to tell you, just start the car. I'm going to pray.
Yeah. And he says,
which is such a bold move. I would never do that.
I would, like, never do that.
Really setting yourself up
for failure.
For either, like, big wins, big losses.
Didn't Jesus tell us, like, do not test the Lord, God? Like, didn't he?
You know, I think this is an area he's a little bit confusing on. Right, but anyway, keep going.
So anyway, so Jeff Cavins does this. He tells the lady to turn the car on. The car starts, and it works.
He said, like, I put my hands on the motor. I think it was the motor.
Or what I believe to be the motor.
Probably the motor. And pray, Lord,
I know nothing about this.
Please start. Okay, go ahead.
So this is exactly what I did. I stopped and I said, Lord, please help me get to my house. I just have to get to my house. Mm-hmm. Because I knew if I could get to my house, I could find an Uber to because I had to get to Haley. Because Haley's at the hospital 2 hours away.
Yeah.
I had to get to Haley the next day. So I was like, if I can just get this to my house, I don't have to worry about this being on the side of the road, and I can figure everything else out later.
Yeah.
So I say this prayer, and I literally, when I said amen, the car starts back up. All the lights, all the crazy lights turn off. Like, everything is just fine. I'm like, what? This actually works. Which is really ironic because, you know, we talk about prayer a whole lot and most of the time on the show. And most of the time when we're praying for other people. We're praying for other things. And a lot of times we don't see the fruits of the prayers at all, right?
Yeah.
And most of the time, even when I'm praying for certain things in my own life, I don't, like, tangibly, viscerally see the answer to that prayer.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right?
Especially instantly.
Yes. It's possibly one of the only times in my life that I said amen, and then it happened. And so anyway, so I'm getting to my house, and there's construction, and in the construction, it goes down to one lane with no shoulders on either side. And I know that if my car stops,
ain't nobody getting
no
by.
No one's getting by.
I'm going to shut this piece down.
Yeah. And it starts revving again. It starts messing up. Anyway, long story short.
Have you ever seen the old show of not Lost in Space. Oh my gosh, what is it? It was like that old television show where they were like, the family was out in space. They remade it. Anyway, they had this like robot that was like, you know, had artificial intelligence, and it would, the Robinsons was the name of the family. Anyway, this robot would like come in when something was happening. He'd be like, danger, Will Robinson.
Oh, yes, I do.
And like he had vacuum tubes for arms. Yes. And they would fling around.
The wacky wavy
like,
fling.
That's the image I'm getting thinking about your car, like with the lights flashing. Yep. It's like, danger, Will Robinson.
Right. Get out.
Something.
My car's literally yelling at me, get out, Adam. Get out. So anyway, I literally pull into my driveway. Still in drive, car is on. I roll into my driveway. As I'm rolling in, the car dies, and I just blissfully glide right to a stop.
Blissfully?
Into my...
The whole experience was so blissful for you.
The very end was incredibly blissful.
I think if I went back and was just there, I'm not sure my observations of you, I would say, he appears blissful.
Dude, I was incredibly happy. Like, it was not I was just thrilled this car is in my driveway.
Yeah. That is pretty incredible.
So I was telling Juan this story, and he goes, dude, you're so stupid. And I was like, okay, well, tell me why. And he goes, why did you just pray to get it to your house? Why didn't you pray that this car lasted for another 10 years?
And I was like, good point.
You know what? I am stupid. That is like, he said, when you ask our Lord in prayer for things, you be specific. You don't just...
Big graces, Adam.
Yeah.
Big graces.
You're limiting our Lord. So anyway, I was really really excited that the van made it back home. And it was just really cool from the spirit, like, that I prayed for something and the Lord just immediately answered that prayer.
Definitely very cool. I hope I never have that story with my new van. I hope never to have that cool experience. Definitely cool for you, though.
Yeah.
Definitely. Very cool for you.
Yeah. So, anyway, that's kind of...
You know, vans are becoming very popular. Millennials in droves driving minivans now.
Totally. I don't know where you're coming up with that. I think you're making this up. But I think that's just kind of our bubble. But
no, they talk about it on the news.
Oh, on the news.
The Business Channel, which I watch all the time.
The Business Channel.
Several times in the last months, they've talked about young people buying minivans. I don't know if millennials still count as young people.
I don't think they do anymore.
But we're on the old side of millennials, so the young side of millennials still might be young people, you know, like 30-ish.
Yeah.
So.
Well, we're sipping on a little Basil Hayden bourbon this evening, as we're going to talk about Dante... and wonder. That's the topic that we'll talk about this evening. So hang around and we will be right back.
A couple years ago, when Adam and I decided we wanted to lead our first pilgrimage, we asked around to find out who should we work with to help do this. And the thing we heard over and over again was Select International Tours. That's who you got to use. They're the best. Well, having used Select now, I can attest that they're incredible. No matter where it is you want to go in the world, Select has a tour ready for you. So whether you're interested in leading a pilgrimage or attending one, do yourself a favor and go to selectinternationaltours.com and take a look at everything they have to offer. You won't regret it. Welcome back to the Catholic Man Show. David Niles here with Adam Minahan. Sitting all by ourselves. What feels like an empty house. I know that there are people here.
Yeah, there's five
children. I'm going to be honest, the vibe is very deserted. I'm getting very deserted vibes.
Well, my homemaker is not here.
Yeah.
So.
That's true. But she did, you know what? She just, you know, she came home.
She did, yes.
This last weekend, which is very cool.
Very good.
How did she take her home visit? Was it?
It was really good.
Was it restful? I wasn't sure. Like, coming home after you know, being gone a month and a half, like...
Yeah, I wouldn't say it was
Are you just reminded of all the things that, like, you haven't, like,
I don't think so. I mean, she had to go pick up the van. She had, like, things that we had to do. It's like, listen, I have to work. Kids are at school. So, you know, she had to coordinate a few things. But I think it was good to touch home base. I think it was good to, be able to see the home again, to sleep in your own bed again, like... from a hospital bed for almost 2 months, to be able to, you know, just be outside, see, you know, feed the chickens and,
yeah,
you know, just kind of be home. I think does the heart well.
Yeah, definitely.
So tonight we're going to talk about, Dante and wonder and what he talks about in wonder. I'll preface the beginning of this conversation with, if you're not following Ascend the Great Books podcast, with our good friend Deacon Harrison Garlick to do that. In fact, specifically right now as we're going through Lent, because he's working through the second part of the Divine Comedy, the Purgatorio.
Yeah, so if you've never read, and he's also got the Inferno on there.
Right.
Which, if you're going to read the Divine Comedy, you should read them in order. Mm-hmm. Don't mm-hmm. skip... Do not skip the Inferno.
Right.
You should read them as he wrote them. But if you don't know anything about the Inferno, honestly, you have to be quite the scholar to be able to sit down and know and really draw what's intended to be drawn out of the Inferno. I don't. or the Divine Comedy in general. I don't want to discourage anyone at all from reading it, because it's so incredibly rich. An amazing... There are only a handful of brilliant writing in the world, right? Like, I'm talking genius-level authors, and Dante was one of them. He was absolutely
a literary master.
I mean, there's no question whether he was that type of author. So there's so much happening, you really do need a guide. Mm-hmm. So hopefully you get a good edition if you're going to do it, where that has a lot of notes. Musa has a really good translation, really good notes.
Eslin
is good. He's good, faithful Catholic, so that really helps. But also go and just listen to the podcasts that the Deacon has done on Ascend. It will be invaluable for your experience and what you get out of it. And he's going to be putting up Purgatorio soon. So
yeah, he just started, I think. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They've worked through Homer, and they're working through Plato, and he's really trying to bring the great books to where everybody can read them, regardless of where you are, whether you're a college student or a high school student, or you're a stay-at-home mom, or you're a dad who's trying to work, or regardless of your state in life, he's wanting it to be accessible to everybody. Mm-hmm. He spends a lot of time being able to articulate what needs to be drawn out of these books, and what the teachers of the great books are trying to teach us, namely the authors of the great books, what are they trying to teach us?
Yeah.
So maybe just a little bit of backstory here on where I'm pulling some of this content from Dante. So Dante lived a crazy life, and Dave, yours is right there. Your notes are right over there by your... the whiskey is what you're looking for. You're pointing at what I thought were the notes, but I was misguided. I apologize. We went to Florence on our pilgrimage.
Yeah.
And we were excited. I was like, let's go to the house of Dante, because there's there. And then I realized, oh, wait. Dante got exiled from Florence.
These guys kicked him out.
Yeah. So
we did get to go to his tomb, though.
Well,
it was just the memorial.
It's just the memorial. Yeah. It wasn't his tomb. Yeah.
When you go by it, you think it's his tomb, because it's right with all the other tombs.
Right. But so Dante gets exiled from Florence. He's part of this political party that there's two main political parties. One of the political parties has two branches, divisions of the political party. One is a papist controls everything party, where
he would be the emperor.
Like the
of
pope
the world.
Would be has the authority of both the spiritual matters and the civil matters. And then there's the other party, which Dante was a part of, where it's no, the pope is in charge of the spiritual matters, but the local governments are in charge of the civil matters. Well, the papal team wins, and then Pope Boniface VIII ends up fining and exiling Dante from Florence.
Not a great pope, we can say that.
Correct. Yeah, he wasn't known to be a great pope.
In fact, we had a pretty long string of not great popes at the time.
I think that's accurate.
Yeah.
And so Dante refuses to pay the fine. And so the punishment was a fine and 2 years of exile. Dante refuses to pay the fine. And Boniface VIII says, okay, his papal authority, I don't know if it was directly from Pope Boniface's mouth, but the papal authority says, okay, you are now exiled, and if you ever come back, we're going to burn you at the stake. And so Dante gets exiled from Florence, and in this time period, this is early 1300s, 1302 to 1308, something like that, 1307, something like that. And at the beginning, he decides he's going to write the convivio, which is the banquet, is what and his idea is this philosophical masterpiece of work. It's going to be a 15 volume set, basically, of
life,
the philosophical understanding of what life is. And he gets to book four and abandons the whole project and starts writing what is known as the Divine Comedy. And because he was writing this philosophical, you know, what he was going to try to be is this philosophical masterpiece, because he was trying to kind of boast like his clout, so to speak, of the philosophy and theology, because he just got kicked out by the papal authority. So he's trying to say like, okay, well, look, I have, look at my writings, look like I have authority. I'm, you know, kind of a authority in my writings, right? But he gets to basically book four, and my understanding is he comes to the realization that you know, philosophical texts only get so far, and that you need reason and wonder to really convey the message that he was trying to convey. Thus, he writes the Divine Comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it just so happens that in the Divine Comedy, in the first part, which is the Inferno, he actually places Pope Boniface VIII in like the eighth circle of hell, while Pope Boniface is still alive.
Yeah, not a fan is, you know, yeah, for and obvious reasons.
So he wasn't so Florence and the Pope was not a big fan of Dante at the time.
So he puts him in the circle of hell of people who have committed simony.
Yeah. And so he's basically face down for all of eternity, getting burned like by the flames in on his feet, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And he was actually, I forget what other Pope. So there was a Pope that was already in the hole where you get placed down into that circle of hell, and there was a Pope already there. And then Pope Boniface is supposed to be on top, mm-hmm, of that Pope. And anyway, I forget which Pope that was, but it's funny in the Inferno, like when they approach, they can't see the person because they're face down. Mm-hmm. So they can't see Dante. So the Pope down there thinks that it's Boniface. And he says, "Oh, Boniface, I didn't realize you were here so early. I thought, you know, it would be still a while before you got here." But it was really just Dante. But before then, he's writing what's called the Convivio, which is translated as the banquet, right? And he breaks down, I find this fascinating, he breaks life down into four parts. And this is like something that's very, I think, not easy to understand as moderns, maybe, like, you know, it, or maybe like kind of cuts against the grain from our understanding of how life is broken out. But he breaks it out into four parts and then talks about the virtues and tasks for each part of the life. And he breaks it down into this: adolescence, which is basically from birth to age 25.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yes.
That he considers them adolescents.
Right. And then what he calls the like youth, which is ages 25 to 45.
See, dude, we're still youths.
We're still the youths.
We're just a mere youth.
And if you look at the, you know, okay, so let me, I'll go through this. So adolescence, birth to 25, youth, 25 to 45, old age from 45 to 70, and then extreme old age or senile 70 plus. And so if you look
There's at no the middle age, you go from youth to old.
To old. So if you look at the bell curve of life, so to speak, right, the pinnacle of life is youth. Ages 25 to 45, namely 33, which is when, you know, he writes the Divine Comedy. This is like very...
Was he 33 years old?
He's 33 years old when he writes the Divine Comedy. Okay. And that's why at the very beginning he talks about he was in the middle state, like midway through life.
Yeah, in the middle of my life, I found myself in a dark wood.
Right, which was when he was 33.
Uh-huh.
Which is what he considers like the pinnacle, like the very top of the bell curve of life.
Yeah. Jesus was 33. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Excuse me. Yeah. So he considers this to be the perfect age because it's the period of greatness, of strength, and basically the most that you can give to the world. Like, this is the age in which you can give back to the world to the fullest degree.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So he talks about adolescence, though, and this is where I kind of really want to hone in on, and we'll go through each of these real quick, but we'll kind of circle back to adolescence because this is, I think, very important as we consider being fathers and raising children.
Okay.
So adolescence, he says, he talks about like the main virtues here that must be grown in or built upon is obedience, wonder, gentleness, or he calls it sweetness, modesty, and then the beauty of the body. Okay, and so like the whole task of adolescence, he says, is to be receptive to the teachings and to rein in the appetites through obedience that you learn from your elders and from your parents.
What does he mean by beauty of the body, do you think?
Creation, like that it's made in his image and likeness.
Okay. So sort of like what we call theology of the body.
Yeah, I think
today.
I he doesn't obviously make that, but this is my understanding that like, uh-huh. You know, the things that this Lord made is good. And so like, and we're talking about building up virtue, right? And so you should see things in accord with reality. And the reality is the body is good.
Right.
And it is beautiful. Mm-hmm. And it's, and if you are this very, quarter of your life, you should be building upon not teaching like about the vices, but teaching about the virtues, right? Virtues become habits. The language that you use become habits, right?
Totally, yeah.
And so I think this is kind of what he's referencing here. Mm-hmm. So that way, when you get into later parts of your life, that you have this understanding of that, no, this is a good and should be treated as such.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I like that. Honestly, it kind of surprises me. I just think about the theology of the body as being, you know, a very modern
revelation. Genesis 2
but,
is
but of
a,
course, of
Genesis
course, it's nothing
is,
new
is
about
pretty,
it.
Yeah, Genesis 2 is pretty modern.
Yeah. Yeah, I
it
mean,
just
that's,
happened.
That's right. It's we're still trying to work through it.
Right. Yeah. So then he talks about youth, which is like what he calls the pinnacle, the perfect age of life. And the virtues here are temperance, courage, love, courtesy, and loyalty. And the task here is to achieve excellence.
He's really big on loyalty. Like, this is one of his big...
I think almost, like, humankind, for all up until, you know, very recently, loyalty was a much higher virtue than what it is seen today.
I think you're right. Yeah. Yeah, just our modern culture promotes more of a, hey, you go get your own.
Which, I know this is... going down a rabbit hole, but I think one of the reasons why of this is because we're able to travel and relocate as we will.
Oh, I have a lot to say about that.
That's a rabbit hole.
Yeah, that is definitely a rabbit hole, but yeah, I'm with you on that. I think there's probably other reasons.
Without
but
a doubt.
Certainly, I think that's a contributing
big factor.
Yeah.
Okay, so he's talking about this perfect age, 25 to 45, and so our task here is to achieve excellence. And Dante argues that at this stage, one must not only govern oneself with temperance and courage, but also open oneself to others, love and courtesy. So this is when you've been formed well enough to where not only can you temper yourself, to where again to go kind of reference our last episode where if you're no means nothing, your yes means nothing. That if you can't say no to certain things, your yes means nothing.
Yeah.
That this should be the age in which you're able to temper yourself so that you can give yourself away. Mm-hmm.
Right. You've learned and now you're putting it into practice, to actually go out and do it. Be temperate.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And then so old age hits at 45 to 70. And it says, as the soul begins to descend down the arch of the bell curve, the bell curve, it focuses, shifts from personal excellence to society and to spiritual leadership. So now you're becoming more of kind of the custodian of tradition. You're becoming mm-hmm. like kind of the grandfather. You're becoming the teacher. You're becoming, that which one should be looked up to. And he says, the virtues here are prudence, justice, generosity, and affability, which is being pleasant in speech.
Yes.
And the task here is to provide counsel to the young and to act as a guardian of the law. Dante believes that the elderly should use their accumulated wisdom to ensure the world remains just, which is also a very strong thread that he weaves throughout
absolutely.
The Divine Comedy. But so if you notice this bell curve, So as we get into old, extreme old age or senile, 70 plus, this is the stage in which the soul prepares to lower the sails and return to the port, which is God.
Yeah.
And so he says the virtues here are gratitude and blessing. And that the tasks that you have at 70 plus is contemplation and recollection. That Dante describes at this stage as the soul looking back on the journey, thanking God for the good voyage it has made. So if you look at the bell curve here at the beginning, it's more focused inward, relying on others.
Uh-huh.
And then as you have been formed and forged in these virtues, it is so that you can go and give back.
Right. You're working on yourself and then you start to work on others.
Right.
Yeah.
Which,
you know, I just think
which slaps.
Oh yeah, dude, it totally slaps. There's just such an order to this and like the virtues that are in each stage.
Which one sticks out the most to you?
The thing that stuck out to me was as we were going through them, it was like, yes. Like there wasn't even much to say about it. It was just like, yes, obvious. Yeah, that's right. It just felt so correct, mm-hmm. You know, at each stage that, you know, in the beginning, you're working on obedience, wonder, gentleness, modesty, and understanding the value of the body. You know, in your 20s and 30s, you're being courageous, you're learning to love, working on loyalty, you know, and then as you get older, justice, prudence, affability, there's just, that is, those things so well described, those, the different ages that he's talking about.
Which again, it goes back to, kind of, again, to our last episode, right? So temperance and you know, fortitude or courage, you know, these are the lower of the four cardinal virtues.
Uh-huh.
And then the higher two cardinal virtues, prudence and justice. So like as you're growing in virtue, you start with the lowers and build up to the higher virtues, mm-hmm. Right? I think that I would be willing to say also that, you know, the 70 plus, the extreme old age, you know, that the task here is contemplation and reconciliation and this, the virtue of gratitude and blessing. I think that that is, you know, spot on, but I also think that, especially now with our age, our life expectancy being a lot longer than what it was back then, that age group really is kind of more of the 45 to 70 as well, that they should be looked up to and sought after for counsel.
Yeah.
And that they should be also playing a role there as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think today he would have that 70 plus much older.
Right.
I don't know what the life expectancy was in the 13th century when he was writing. I'm quite sure it was much, much, much. I mean, it was probably in the 50s, mm-hmm. or even the 40s. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
The Bible, I'm sure he picked 70 because the Old Testament says 70 are the number of a man's years, 80 if he's strong. So I would imagine being the biblical scholar that he was, that's mm-hmm. probably why he picked 70.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, if someone made it to 70, it's why it's extreme old age. I mean, that would have been like, wow, that guy's 70? You
right.
know, you wouldn't know very many 70-year-olds.
Right.
So that would be like today, like a 90, you know, 90.
Right.
Certainly, you know, 90. I mean, it happens, but not for most people.
Yeah. So I want to talk about like I want to kind of focus on adolescence today, because I think most of the people who are listening to their show are probably in the age range of 25 to 45 or 45 plus, you know? And so we're in this age of either youth, according to Dante.
Gosh, I just love that.
Or old age.
I just love that you and I are still youths.
This is about the only time we're still there.
No wonder Dante, I like him so much.
Yeah.
You know?
So Dante, you know, so again, this is a philosophical treatise. So he's drawing off of Aristotle a lot, and from Thomas Aquinas. He says that Thomas Aquinas is like the master when it comes to the Nicomachean ethics and like.
Just like context about he was, Dante was what you might call the grand student of Aquinas. He was the student of the student of Aquinas. So
that's right. Yeah. So Dante.
He's very connected to Aquinas, was a big promoter of Aquinas. He was promoting Aquinas when nobody knew who he was.
Yeah. My understanding was that he actually read, he got access to some of Aristotle's work only because of Aquinas. But Dante, or Aquinas died right when Dante was somewhere around like 8 or 9 years old. So their paths never crossed physically. Yeah. But Dante was taught by a Dominican friar who was taught by Aquinas. Mm-hmm. And so that's why, yeah, a grand student basically of Aquinas.
He'd be like the gospel writer Mark.
But yes.
You know, yeah. Who's taught by Peter, who was taught by Jesus.
Right.
You know?
It's like, that's a pretty good
lineage. We're talking about it pretty close, okay? Mm-hmm.
So he talks about wonder, and he obviously draws from the Aristotelian understanding of what wonder is, and I think some of these things, that how he defines wonder, is really beautiful. Also, there's this book, just to kind of plug, by Dennis Quinn. It's not in print anymore, so it's kind of tough to find, but if you ever find it, it's well worth picking up. Dennis Quinn was one of the three KU teachers with John Sr. Uh-huh. and Nellick, I think is
part of that. He was one of the three professors
in the humanities program. At KU. Mm-hmm. And it's called Iris Exiled. It's a synoptic history of wonder. And it's a fascinating book. But he cites that wonder excites, it disturbs, it agitates, it seizes the attention and stimulates the effort to find an answer, is how he's kind of describes wonder.
So I think we lack wonder so much today because answers are so easy to find. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we have the true blessing here in the Diocese of Tulsa in eastern Oklahoma to have a guy by the name of David Dean in our diocese, who was like the associate teacher with John Sr. Since you're talking about the great humanities program, John Sr. was sort of known as like...
Also the godchild of John Sr.
Yeah, well, yeah, so David Dean converted and asked John Sr. To be his godfather. So he helped teach his Latin class.
Yep. Okay,
and which is one of the classes the humanities program was very well known
We've
for.
We've actually talked about this on the show. If you just go to thecatholicmanshow.com and just search David Dean, you'll be able to find the episode that we did.
Super cool guy. So I have taken David Dean's Latin class. So I'm sort of like the Dante.
You're like the great John grand.
Senior. I'm the student of the student of John Sr.
You're a great okay? grand. Yeah.
But the fascinating thing is that the way David Dean teaches is very pro wonder. So sometimes there would be a word we didn't know what it meant, and he wouldn't tell us. Because wonder was such an integral part of that humanities program, where they would go out stargazing. You know, the professors would intentionally do things to stimulate wonder in the mind, which we don't have at all, because everything is a chat, you know, is just a Google search away. Mm-hmm. Even now, complicated things you can ask ChatGPT or Gemini, and like, there's, because of that also, there's no value in the information. What I have learned about wondering about something is that when I finally get that answer, it's a treasure now that I have. It's not just a passing commodity. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just, oh, cool. It's not trivial. It's something that I get quickly and just as quickly throw away. Mm-hmm. So there are times where I want to Google something and I say, no. Let's wonder about it. And eventually you do need to get the answer somehow. It's much better if you find someone who knows the answer. You can talk to them. Have a learning information through conversation is so much better for the memory. Mm-hmm. So anyway, it's just wonder is so missing from today. And these guys who you're mentioning here, they knew how important it was, and it was such a big part of that humanities program, which was so wildly successful they shut it down.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And so Aristotle even talks about wonder, and he says like this is wonder is like the recognition that reality is greater than your grasp. Like this is the beauty of wonder, right? Is that it's the shock of the soul before it exceeds it. It's that you sit there and you realize, because I don't know that this leads to something greater, and I can't put my finger on it. In here, Dante makes a big caveat, or maybe a claim to make sure that we don't mistake wonder for ignorance, right? Because he says it's more of like a luminous ignorance is what wonder is. It's knowing that there is more to be known. So ignorance is like just not even, I was ignorant about this. I didn't even know about this.
Yeah, yeah.
Wonder is more that I do know that there's more to be learned about this. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, wonder has this way of elevating. It draws you higher, right?
It ascends.
Yes, you do ascend, and because it, like you said, you have this recognition of this higher thing, and your mind yearns for it, and it draws your whole soul up to it, even though you're not there, you can't quite hold it. Mm-hmm. You still orbit around this good, or you know, whatever it might be, and so you're participating in this hierarchy, even though you haven't yet landed
there. Yes,
yes,
yeah, absolutely. And so Dante says that adolescence, mainly, you know, 0 to 25 years old, is uniquely disposed to cultivating wonder. If we can cultivate, like they can grow in wonder for three reasons. He says because their rational powers are awakening. Like they're realizing their rational powers, that their appetites are strong, but they're not tyrannical yet.
Hmm. Yeah, they're still innocent.
They're still innocent. And that their imagination is still vivid and unflattened.
You know what a kid has never wondered about? Anything he saw on a screen.
No.
He's been maybe curious. He's probably, you know, asked questions. But there is no wonder. Like, wonder is going out in your backyard.
The screen is the flattening.
It absolutely just pancakes reality literally into a flat screen.
To pixels, yeah.
Wonder is going out into your backyard and all of a sudden finding a flower that was not there yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Where did this come from? How did it get here? And you look at its beauty. You behold its magnificence. And it... How did this be? It's here and it's real. You can feel it, smell it. I mean, that doesn't happen on a screen.
Mm-hmm.
So if you really want to instill wonder in your kids, take away all of their screens. Every screen you've given to your child is a disservice. And I know that's a strong statement, but you can maybe have, you know, family stuff. I don't want to, I'm being a little hyperbolic, but not that much. Okay. They should be outside.
Breaking news, David being hyperbolic.
Strong feelings about things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what?
I have strong opinions. This is, and I'll tell you, of my strong opinions, this is a very strong one.
This reminds me of the story that they talk about with G.K. Chesterton, where he's in the kitchen and he's looking out the window and his wife is in the living room. What is his wife's name? Margaret? I don't know.
I don't remember. Sorry.
Yeah, whatever his wife's name was, he goes, honey, get in here. Like all frantic. And she comes running in thinking something's wrong. He's staring out at the, out the window. And she goes, what is wrong? What is it? And he goes, honey, the grass is green.
And G.K. Chesterton was a champion of wonder.
Yeah. And like, I'm sure she probably hit him.
Gosh, you are the worst sometimes.
Yeah.
Other times, unbelievably cool. But,
yeah.
You know.
But you are my cross.
I thought somebody was dying.
Yeah. But he has this unique childlike innocence to him and awe and wonder.
Does. Yeah. I love, I'm going to get mess it up, but he's got this great line where he talks about maybe God doesn't make daisies all alike because, you know, maybe he just never gets tired of making them. You know, and like a child who says, do it again. mm-hmm. do it again. Mm-hmm. You know, you'll throw them in the air or something. Do it again. They never get tired of it. But when we get old, we do, and we have grown older than our creator or something like that. You know, like our creator is younger than we are. Mm-hmm. It's such a great line. It's just dripping with wonder. The way he writes stuff.
Well, and you can tell through his writing how it just oozes, wondrous type of language. Yes.
Oh yeah, absolutely. He's a great example for this conversation.
Yeah. So okay, so Dante says like there. So adolescence. He goes on to defend why adolescence is the critical moment for cultivating wonder. So we'll go through a couple of these and see what your thoughts are. Okay. But so he says. That he observes that adolescents, they ask big questions instinctively, mm-hmm. without realize, instinctively, like ask big questions. There are times in which I have like come to be like, oh, this is a good question, mm-hmm. but I've had to think about it and like ponder about it, and then realize like, oh, this is a good question, and then like all of a sudden your kid asks just offhand. In a matter of seconds, about if God made everything, who made God?
Mm-hmm. And the thing about their questions is that you don't think they don't sound like profound questions until you try to answer them.
Right, but they're big questions. That's why I like he said yes. Like they're big. They're
but they're
important
simple.
Questions.
They're like big, right. But they ask you a question and you're like, well, and then you try to answer it and you realize. That is a huge question. That's a big question.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and they're capable of all reverence and intellectual longing. And this is what I think we do a disservice to that age group. And I have found even with, my oldest is 12 now, that sometimes I've caught myself curbing or dumbing down certain topics for my 12-year-old, because I'm like, I want to make sure he understands it, when in reality, he's actually looking for a more in-depth, a more rich answer that I'm not actually, like, I'm kind of curbing his intellect instead of, like, being the catalyst to push it forward.
Yeah, he's at a peak asking to shed light on what's way out before him.
Also, it's like, don't ask me too hard of questions.
Yeah,
this,
I don't know.
This
That's,
is on you.
I told you, ask your mother.
Yeah. So he says, if wonder is cultivated in the adolescent soul, the soul learns to love truth before using it.
Say that again.
He says, if wonder is cultivated in the adolescent soul, the soul learns to love truth before using it.
Hmm. That's pretty good.
Right?
That slaps right there.
Yeah. It learns to admire greatness before competing with it. And it learns humility before power. So, I thought those three insights were just so rich and just mm-hmm. worthy of contemplating that if wonder is cultivated, that because this is the desire, this is the whole purpose of school. Right, is that they fall in love with truth.
Yeah, that is the purpose of education.
Right, is that they fall in love with truth before using it, mm-hmm. right? Before going out and again, before going out and spreading it, it's like, I'm just so in love with this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think one of the things that we do to ourselves as we get older is that we convince ourselves that we know too much. Or that we know things. We know everything. Not that we ever actually think we know everything, but that as we go about our life, we feel like we know what there is to know, right? Which is incredibly false, mm-hmm. right? And so we kind of inoculate ourselves against wonder, which children have not done, mm-hmm. right? They're full of the, they know very well. I don't know. There are things I need to learn. That's what I do all the time as I learn. And, we should really try to maintain that attitude about intellectual humility almost. Mm-hmm. That, no, I know almost nothing.
Well, this is actually exactly what Dante says. I don't know if you actually read this or that was just your insights there. But the next thing he talks about is like, if wonder is stifled, the adolescent soul treats knowledge as a tool and not as a gift.
Yeah. Which, that's what we do now. I mean, that's exactly what we do with, the readiness of information. It's just meaning. It's not precious.
Right.
Yeah.
It's not.
And we feel like we earned it. Like it's not a gift. Oh, I just got it, and I threw it away.
Right.
There's no reason I would need to care for this,
Yeah. Excuse me. And so Dante is clear here in this writing. Excuse me. I'm sorry. So Dante is clear, though. He says, like, once wonder is crushed, it is very hard to resurrect. And so this is why he spends so much time focusing on the importance of wonder in this adolescence phase, because it is the ripe age in cultivating this virtue, again, because they have rational powers, are awakening, they're realizing things, their appetites are strong, but not too strong to overtake their will, and that their imagination is still vivid, and they're able to still, grasp things in reality for what it truly is.
Mm-hmm.
And so he says, though, once it's crushed, it's incredibly hard to resurrect.
Yeah, I mean, I could see that. I think that you can do it.
But it's very hard. I mean, like, remember when we used to have, like, your dreams that you had as a kid? Maybe you don't. I mean, you're narcoleptic, so you probably don't remember a lot of
I mean, are you thinking about, like, a specific genre or something?
No, I can just remember as a kid, I had so much, like...
Okay, you meant that generally. I didn't know if you were actually, like, trying to... talk about like specific dreams.
No. I'm just saying, like, I remember when I had dreams as a kid, they were very vivid, very creative. Like, it was like, wow, that was, very wild. It was very awe inspiring. It was very wondrous. It was it was something like, I can't believe, my subconsciousness or whatever, like, thought of this. Now I have more, dreams about, like, so is orange a color or is it a fruit? And have like a debate with myself whether or not it's a color or a fruit.
You don't really do that, do you?
I have had that. I have had that dream before.
What did you decide?
I was fighting with myself on it. And then actually you came in and you were like, you're stupid. And then I woke up.
That's my favorite one of your dreams.
This is why I've never told you that dream before.
Dave, can you help me out? Yeah.
You're stupid.
You're an idiot.
Yeah. Well, this is the second reference on this show of one of my friends calling me stupid. Juan and Dave.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. You have to wonder about what that means. Yeah. Just
connect,
why don't you wonder
the dots
about
or
that?
Not? Okay. So now he's talking about he gives educational warnings on teaching with wonder. So he says, like, the burden... He says, Dante is warning against miseducation when it comes to wonder and to... What's wrong?
Nothing.
Oh.
I just pointed at the time there.
Oh, okay. And so he cautions to make it, when you're teaching to make it purely utilitarian, endless techniques, like how to memorize certain things or, something like that, endless techniques to learn.
Mm-hmm.
Moralism without beauty and knowledge without mystery. And then he says, if you do any of those things,
all of those things
to age the soul too fast.
All of those things sound like socialism to me. I mean, don't they? Like, moralism without beauty, knowledge without mystery. It's just like, these are communist ideals. And pure utility. And there's a technique for it. I mean, it's just incredibly communist.
Right.
All of that. I mean, it just describes the communist culture.
So maybe to put this in practical terms or like modern terms, Dante, I think, would say when you're teaching and you're trying to cultivate wonder, it should not be dominated by these three questions. Like, what will you do with this? How will this benefit you? or what's the fastest explanation. That's not how you're going to cultivate wonder, but instead it should be filled with poetry, great stories, noble examples, and questions without immediate answers. Wonder prepares the soul for truth. It does not replace it.
Do you ever write poetry? Do you ever try to
do that? Yeah, I have. Not very good at it, but I did write. I did write Haley a poem one time, and once I wrote it, I was like, "That's really." I was pretty proud of it. I never gave it to her though.
I'm keeping this for me. I wrote it for her, but I want it.
Well, it was like, I thought like, that's pretty good for me. It's still not very good, but pretty good for me.
Yeah, better than you thought.
Yeah.
It's a good, it's, you know what? I think it's, if we want to talk about wonder, I think there's a beauty in writing a poem and like working on it and then just letting it go.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, because it removes the utility completely from, you know, it's kind of what this is talking about. You just throw it away.
Yeah.
Why would you do it? Because it was good to do. I didn't want to have it. I didn't
There's
need
so
it.
Many ties.
I didn't want to do anything with it. I just wanted to write it.
There's so many ties to wonder and leisure.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, in fact, I can't believe that we haven't mentioned the word leisure yet because they're like prerequisites of each other, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you can't really have leisure without wonder, and you certainly can't have wonder without leisure, you know?
Okay. So I know we've gone probably longer than what we thought we were going to, but okay. So I just wanted to like talk about how wonder is the seeds of love and virtue. So one of Dante's most profound insights in the Convivio in this book, I think it's book 4, if I remember correctly. He says that you cannot love that which you have never wondered at. Love of wisdom presupposes wonder at being. Love of God presupposes wonder at creation. Moral excellence presupposes admiration for the good. And so if adolescence then is not about forcing conclusions, but about ordering loves, which I love, like that is so profound. So, you know, wonder teaches the soul what is worth loving before it learns how to act.
Which that really jives with what we said about education. I mean, adolescence here is essentially the age of education. Mm-hmm. And my favorite definition of education is ordering the appetites, forming the appetites to desire the true, the good, and the beautiful. Mm-hmm. That's really what you're trying to do. And using truth, obviously, you know, conveying truth is one of the ways you teach them to love it, right? Because you can't love that which you do not know. So it's interesting here that he says you cannot love something you've never wondered at.
Mm-hmm. Which is what contemplation.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the contemplative life.
And that he says, you know, that adolescence, which we said is, you know, education, is really just about ordering loves or, you know, forming those appetites.
Yeah. So, Here's kind of the last thing I thought was very profound. I mean, the whole thing is very profound. It's worth reading. I enjoyed reading it. It's one of those that when you read it, you should underline as you go, and then reread it again, and then see what you underlined and make notes, because it's just going to. Dante is the prime example of every time that you read it, something else kind of stands out, pops out, like you realize a connection that you didn't before, and you want to make sure you note it for the next time so you can build upon it.
He writes so easily in layers, mm-hmm. right? That it's not even just the meaning of his words, but what words did he use? Like, what is the genre here? What is the impression that these words give you? I mean, he uses all of these things to convey his meaning, because he's such an artistic writer.
Yeah, without a doubt. So, okay, so let me, here's one of the last sayings that I'll leave with you. I'll get your thoughts. He says, if you educate adolescents without wonder, you may make them competent, but you will not make them wise. And worse, you may make them incapable of wisdom at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that is just true. You can teach them all kinds of information. You know, is AI wise? Does AI have wisdom? It knows everything that it conceivably knows all that it has, you know, all of humanity's acquired knowledge.
Yeah.
It very easily, very conceivably could have possession of all of that at its fingertips, you know, just like with this incredible comprehension. And yet for all of that would not have an ounce of wisdom. You know, and of course that's a computer. So it's like, well, that's why, but you could do the same thing. You could teach someone in the same way. And I think, you know, there's probably people, you know, who like, oh yes, that person's very smart. You ask them a question and they will regurgitate this information. Like they're just kind of that way. They know all this stuff, but they have not wisdom, mm-hmm. You know? You know, then they don't have God in their life, for instance. You know, they're uber smart.
Or their knowledge is a mile wide but an inch deep.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So it's absolutely, absolutely possible. I'd rather have my children. One of the things we say at our homeschool is we're trying to get these, I want my kids to get into heaven, not Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, you know, religious education, that's a much heavier emphasis.
I'd love for them to be capable of going to Harvard.
Absolutely.
And so that way we can reject it.
That's right. Yes. Like I want Harvard to accept them and then we throw it in the burn it or I don't know. I honestly have nothing specifically against Harvard, only that it's among this group of educations that I think are worthless. So, you know, and incredibly overpriced. If you just think about it, what kind of person do you want to be? Do you want to be the person who just like, who knows? Like, would you rather, if you could snap your fingers, have like knowledge or understanding?
Understanding without a doubt.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, right. There's just there's so much richness in wisdom. The wise, you know, okay, I think about this because we've spent a fair amount of time at Clear Creek. I was buying a book. In fact, it was Father Bethel's book there. Father Bethel at the time was the prior, you know, pretty, you know, second in command at the time, mm-hmm. of the Abbey. He put out a book.
Unrealism and John Senior?
Yeah. And so I was buying it, and the monk there, who is running the cash register, I said, have you read it? And he goes, oh, no. And you don't even know how good of an impression that was. I just did. And I was laughing because I was kind of surprised that he's like, oh, no, I haven't read it. And I said, oh, I won't tell him. You know, just kidding. He goes, well, I suppose there are plenty of other monks here who maybe have read it and they know that sort of thing very well. And I just, I just don't need to know it, I guess. And he said this all with like such humility. And I'm being honest. That was an incredibly good impression. But it was just so interesting how like he knew he didn't need to know this stuff. And yet it was very clear, like this old monk is very wise.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the very fact that he would say, oh no, that's okay. I don't need to know that, you know, like I've checked my curiosity for knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
I pursue the things that are, you know, rightly ordered with, you know, my station in life and like what I'm doing, you know, and it was just there was so much wisdom in his lack of knowledge.
Right.
And that's an interaction that has stuck with me for years now, because it was, first of all, it was very unusual, but in a sort of enlightening way.
Yeah, because at first you thought, like, dude, you're gonna get in trouble. Like, your boss,
you should definitely read his book.
Yeah,
you know, and it's in the bookstore where you work. Right? Yeah. Feel like you could squeeze it in.
Anyway, I just found I find Dante fascinating. I find his writings fascinating, and this work that, you know, isn't really ever talked about, or at least in it's not as commonly talked about as Divine Comedy, but it's still so rich. And you know, as I reflect as a dad, you know, how I'm raising my children, I'm constantly trying to consider and fight the urge to teach them for utilitarian purposes, or teach them that the hacks of how to, like, know things quickly. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there are some good ones, especially with math. You know, there's some good tricks, but that's not the purpose.
But to learn slow, and to spend time, and to wonder.
Yeah. Yeah, learning how to learn is really more important than learning.
Anyway, that's all I got.
Very good. We're on the Lord's team.
The winning side.
So raise your glass.